This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. Recorded by Christy Mellock. The History of England from the Accession of James II by Thomas Babington Macaulay. Book 1, Chapter 5, Part 18. Jeffreys boasted that he had hanged more traitors than all his predecessors together since the conquest. It is certain that the number of persons whom he put to death in 1 month and in one shire very much exceeded the number of all the political offenders who have been put to death in our island since the Revolution. The rebellions of 1715 and 1745 were of longer duration, of wider extent, and of more formidable aspect than that which was put down at Sedgemoor. It has not been generally thought that, either after the rebellion of 1715 or after the rebellion of 1745, the House of Hanover erred on the side of clemency. Yet, all the executions of 1715 and 1745 added together will appear to have been few indeed when compared with those which disgraced the bloody assizes. The number of the rebels whom Jeffreys hanged on this circuit was 320. Such havoc must have excited disgust, even if the sufferers had been generally odious. But they were, for the most part, men of blameless life and of high religious profession. They were regarded by themselves and by a large portion of their neighbors not as wrongdoers, but as martyrs who sealed with blood the truth of the Protestant religion. Very few of the convicts professed any repentance for what they had done. Many, animated by the old Puritan spirit, met death not merely with fortitude, but with exultation. It was in vain that the ministers of the established church lectured them on the guilt of rebellion and on the importance of priestly absolution. The claim of the king to unbounded authority in things temporal and the claim of the clergy to the spiritual power of binding and loosing moved to the bitter scorn of the intrepid sectaries. Some of them composed hymns in the dungeon and chanted them on the fatal sledge. Christ, they sang while they were undressing for the butchery, would soon come to rescue Zion and to make war on Babylon. Would set up his standard, would blow his trumpet, and would requite his foes tenfold for all the evil which had been inflicted on his servants. The dying words of these men were noted down, their farewell letters were kept as treasures, and in this way, with the help of some invention and exaggeration, was formed a copious supplement to the Marian Martyrology. A few cases deserve special mention. Abraham Holmes, a retired officer of the Parliamentary Army, and one of those zealots who would own no king but King Jesus, had been taken at Sedgemoor. His arm had been frightfully scattered in the battle, and as no surgeon was at hand, the stout old soldier amputated it himself. He was carried up to London and examined by the king in council, but would make no submission. "I am an aged man," he said, "and what remains to me of life is not worth a falsehood or a baseness. I have always been a Republican, and I am so still." He was sent back to the West and hanged. The people remarked with awe and wonder that the beasts which were to drag him to the gallows became restive and went back. Holmes himself doubted not that the angel of the Lord, as in the old time, stood in the way, sword in hand, invisible to human eyes, but visible to the inferior animals. "Stop, gentlemen," he cried. "Let me go on foot. There is more in this than you think. Remember how the ass saw him whom the prophet could not see." He walked manfully to the gallows, harangued the people with a smile, prayed fervently that God would hasten the downfall of Antichrist and the deliverance of England, and went up the ladder with an apology for mounting so awkwardly. "You see," he said, "I have but one arm." Not less courageously died Christopher Balticombe, a young Templar of good family and fortune, who at Dorchester, an agreeable provincial town proud of its taste and refinement, was regarded by all as the model of a fine gentleman. Great interest was made to save him. It was believed through the west of England that he was engaged to a young lady of gentle blood, the sister of the sheriff, that she threw herself at the feet of Jeffreys to beg for mercy, and that Jeffreys drove her from him with a jest so hideous that to repeat it would be an offense against decency and humanity. Her lover suffered at Lyme piously and courageously. A still deeper interest was excited by the fate of two gallant brothers, William and Benjamin Hewling. They were young, handsome, accomplished, and well-connected. Their maternal grandfather was named Kiffin. He was one of the first merchants in London, and was generally considered as the head of the Baptists. The Chief Justice behaved to William Hewling on the trial with characteristic brutality. "You have a grandfather," he said, "who deserves to be hanged as richly as you." The poor lad, who was only 19, suffered death with so much meekness and fortitude that an officer of the army who attended the execution and who had made himself remarkable by rudeness and severity was strangely melted and said, "I do not believe that my Lord Chief Justice himself could be proof against this." Hopes were entertained that Benjamin would be pardoned. One victim of tender years was surely enough for one house to furnish. Even Jeffreys was, or pretended to be, inclined to lenity. The truth was that one of his kinsmen, from whom he had large expectations, and whom therefore he could not treat as he generally treated intercessors, pleaded strongly for the afflicted family. Time was allowed for reference France to London. The sister of the prisoner went to Whitehall with the petition. Many courtiers wished her success, and Churchill, among whose numerous faults cruelty had no place, obtained admittance for her. "I wish well to your suit with all my heart," he said as they stood together in the antechamber. "But do not flatter yourself with hopes. This marble," and he laid his hand on the chimney piece, "is not harder than the king." The prediction proved true. James was inexorable. Benjamin Hewling died with dauntless courage, amidst lamentations in which the soldiers who kept guard round the gallows could not refrain from joining. Yet those rebels who were doomed to death were less to be pitied than some of the survivors. Several prisoners, to whom Jeffreys was unable to bring home the charge of high treason, were convicted of misdemeanors and were sentenced to scourging not less terrible than that which Oates had undergone. A woman, for some idle words, such as had been uttered by half the women in the districts where the war had raged, was condemned to be whipped through all the market towns in the county of Dorset. She suffered part of her punishment before Jeffreys returned to London, but when he was no longer in the West, the jailers, with humane connivance of the magistrates, took on themselves the responsibility of sparing her any further torture. A still more frightful sentence was passed on a lad named Tuchin, who was tried for seditious words. He was, as usual, interrupted in his defense by ribaldry and scurrility from the judgment seat. "You are a rebel, and all your family have been rebels since Adam. They tell me that you are a poet. I'll cap verses with you." The sentence was that the boy should be imprisoned 7 years and should, during that period, be flogged through every market town in Dorsetshire every year. The women in the galleries burst into tears. The clerk of the arraigns stood up in great disorder. "My lord," he said, "the prisoner is very young. There are many market towns in our county. The sentence amounts to a whipping once a fortnight for 7 years." "If he is a young man," said Jeffreys, "he is an old rogue. Ladies, you do not know the villain as well as I do. The punishment is not half bad enough for him. All the interest in England shall not alter it." Tuchin, in his despair, petitioned, and probably with sincerity, that he might be hanged. Fortunately for him, he was, just at this conjuncture, taken ill of the smallpox and given over. As it seemed highly improbable that the sentence would ever be executed, the Chief Justice consented to remit it, in return for a bribe which reduced the prisoner to poverty. The temper of Tuchin, not originally very mild, was exasperated to madness by what he had undergone. He lived to be known as one of the most acrimonious and pertinacious enemies of the House of Stuart and of the Tory party. The number of prisoners whom Jeffreys transported was 841. These men, more wretched than their associates who suffered death, were distributed into gangs and bestowed on persons who enjoyed favor at court. The conditions of the gift were that the convicts should be carried beyond sea as slaves, that they should not be emancipated for 10 years, and that the place of their banishment should be some West Indian island. This last article was studiously framed for the purpose of aggravating the misery of the exiles. In New England or New Jersey, they would have found a population kindly disposed to them and a climate not unfavorable to their health and vigor. It was therefore determined that they should be sent to colonies where a Puritan could hope to inspire little sympathy, and where a laborer born in the temperate zone could hope to enjoy little health. Such was the state of the slave market that these bondmen, long as was the passage, and sickly as they were likely to prove, were still very valuable. It was estimated by Jeffreys that, on average, each of them, after all charges were paid, would be worth from 10 to 15 pounds. There was therefore much angry competition for grants. Some Tories in the West conceived that they had, by their exertions and sufferings during the insurrection, earned a right to share in the profits which had been eagerly snatched up by the sycophants of Whitehall. The courtiers, however, were victorious. The misery of the exiles fully equaled that of the Negroes who are now carried from Congo to Brazil. It appears from the past information which is at present accessible that more than one-fifth of those who were shipped were flung to sharks before the end of the voyage. The human cargoes were stowed close in the holds of small vessels. So little space was allowed that the wretches, many of whom were still tormented by unhealed wounds, could not all lie down at once without lying on one another. They were never suffered to go on deck. The hatchway was constantly watched by sentinels armed with hangers and blunderbusses. In the dungeon below, all was darkness, stench, lamentation, disease, and death. Of 99 convicts who were carried out in one vessel, 22 died before they reached Jamaica, although the voyage was performed at usual speed. The survivors, when they arrived at their house of bondage, were mere skeletons. During some weeks, coarse biscuit and fetid water had been doled out to them in such scanty measure that any one of them could easily have consumed the ration which was assigned to 5. They were, therefore, in such a state that the merchant to whom they had been consigned found it expedient to fatten them before selling them. Meanwhile, the property both of the rebels who had suffered death and of those more unfortunate men who were withering under the tropical sun was fought for and torn in pieces by a crowd of greedy informers. By law, a subject attainted of treason forfeits his substance, and this law was enforced after the bloody assizes with a rigor at once cruel and ludicrous. The broken-hearted widows, the destitute orphans of the laboring men whose corpses hung at the crossroads, were called upon by the agents of the treasury to explain what had become of a basket, of a goose, of a flitch of bacon, of a keg of cider, of a sack of beans, of a truss of hay. While the humbler retainers of the government were pillaging the families of the slaughtered peasants, the Chief Justice was fast accumulating a fortune out of the plunder of the higher class of Whigs. He traded largely in pardons. His most lucrative transaction of this kind was with a gentleman named Edmund Prideaux. It is certain that Prideaux had not been in arms against the government, and it is probable that his only crime was the wealth which he had inherited from his father, an eminent lawyer who had been high in office under the Protector. No exertions were spared to make out a case for the Crown. Mercy was offered to some prisoners on condition that they would bear evidence against Prideaux. The unfortunate man lay long in jail, and at length, overcome by fear of the gallows, consented to pay £15,000 for his liberation. This great sum was received by Jeffreys. He bought with it an estate to which the people gave the name of Atheldama, from that accursed field which was purchased with the price of innocent blood. He was ably assisted in the work of extortion by the crew of parasites who were in the habit of drinking and laughing with him. The office of these men was to drive hard bargains with convicts under the strong terrors of death, and with parents trembling for the lives of children. A portion of the spoil was abandoned by Jeffreys to his agents. To one of his boon companions, it is said, he tossed a pardon for a rich trader across the table during a revel. It was not safe to have recourse to any intercession except that of his creatures, for he guarded his profitable monopoly of mercy with jealous care. It is even suspected that he sent some persons to the gibbet solely because they applied for the royal clemency through channels independent of him. Some courtiers nevertheless contrived to obtain a small share of this traffic. The ladies of the Queen's household distinguished themselves preeminently by rapacity and hard-heartedness. Part of the disgrace which they incurred falls on their mistress, for it was solely on account of the relation in which they stood to her that they were able to enrich themselves by so odious a trade, and there can be no question that she might with a word or a look have restrained them. But in truth, she encouraged them by her evil example, if not by her express approbation. She seems to have been one of that large class of persons who bear adversity better than prosperity. While her husband was a subject and an exile, shut out from public employment, and in imminent danger of being deprived of his birthright, the suavity and humility of her manners conciliated the kindness even of those who most abhorred her religion. But when her good fortune came, her good nature disappeared. The meek and affable Duchess turned out an ungracious and haughty queen. The misfortunes which she subsequently endured had made her an object of some interest, but that interest would not be a little heightened if it could be shown that, in the season of her greatness, she saved, or even tried to save, one single victim from the most frightful proscription that England has ever seen. Unhappily, the only request that she is known to have preferred touching the rebels was that 100 of those who were sentenced to transportation might be given to her. The profit which she cleared on the cargo, after making a large allowance for those who died of hunger and fever during the passage, cannot be estimated at less than 1,000 guineas. We cannot wonder that her attendants should have imitated her unprincely greediness and her unwomanly cruelty. They exacted 1,000 pounds from Roger Hoare, a merchant of Bridgewater, who had contributed to the military chest of the rebel army. But the prey on which they pounced most eagerly was one which it might have been thought that even the most ungentle natures would have spared. Already, some of the girls who had presented the standard to Monmouth at Taunton had cruelly expiated their offense. One of them had been thrown into prison, where an infectious malady was raging. She had sickened and died there. Another presented herself at the bar before Jeffreys to beg for mercy. "Take her, jailer," vociferated the judge, with one of those frowns which had often struck terror into stouter hearts than hers. She burst into tears, drew her hood over her face, followed the jailer out of the court, fell ill with fright, and in a few hours was a corpse. Most of the young ladies, however, who had walked in the procession were still alive. Some of them were under 10 years of age. All had acted under the orders of their schoolmistress without knowing that they were committing a crime. The Queen's maids of honor asked the royal permission to wring money out of the parents of the poor children, and the permission was granted. An order was sent down to Taunton that all these little girls should be seized and imprisoned. Sir Francis Hoare of Hestercombe, the Tory member for Bridgewater, was requested to undertake the office of exacting the ransom. He was charged to declare in strong language that the maids of honor would not endure delay, that they were determined to prosecute to outlawry unless a reasonable sum were forthcoming, and that by a reasonable sum was meant 7,000 pounds. Hoare excused himself from taking any part in a transaction so scandalous. The maids of honor then requested William Penn to act for them, and Penn accepted the commission. Yet it would seem that a little of the pertinacious scrupulosity which he had often shown about taking off his hat would not have been altogether out of place on this occasion. He probably silenced the remonstrances of his conscience by repeating to himself that none of the money which he extorted would go into his own pocket, that if he refused to be the agents of the ladies, they would find agents less humane, that by complying, he should increase his influence at the court, and that his influence at the court had already enabled him, and still might enable him, to render great services to his oppressed brethren. The maids of honor were at last forced to content themselves with less than a third part of what they had demanded. End of part 18.